Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After Dylann Roof confessed to shooting and killing nine black people at a prayer meeting in their historic Charleston, South Carolina church last week, the question of how to describe or define Roof and his actions has emerged as the subject of national debate. Roof has explained his heinous actions as ideologically motivated to inspire fear. But some media outlets, including NPR, have taken a wait-and-see approach, and many politicians have been loath to describe the killings as terrorism or Roof as a terrorist. Today, we're talking about how we define and label certain crimes and why it matters. Joining us now in the studio is political scientist Jason Kiber. He specializes in counterterrorism and has taught courses on terrorism at Ohio State University and will be teaching at Otterbein University in the fall. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Jason, why does the description or definition of such a crime matter?
Right. I think it matters at least in four different dimensions. Morally, it matters because terrorism is a specifically heinous type of crime. And we can maybe get into the weeds about what terrorism is in a minute. But it targets innocent people for broader ideological or political purposes. So morally, it seems like we want to get it right, to accurately describe what's happening. Legally, it matters because in the U.S., acts of terrorism are going to face harsher punishments. And then also there are going to be different standards of prosecution to prosecute an act of terrorism than, let's say, a regular act of murder. Practically, it matters because we want to understand the causes of terrorism. So if we can... And I mean, terrorism tends to be a phenomenon with its own unique set of causes. It's definitely distinct than...
You mean each act of terrorism?
Well, terrorism a little bit more broadly construed. But if practically we... So this is where I would come from as a social scientist. Mm-hmm. If we have an understanding of what causes different types of terrorism, then perhaps we can... craft better policies to address terrorism. So as a practical matter, it's good to know, is such and such an act of terrorism, so we can craft better policy responses in particular. I think that'd be the practical upshot of it. Mm-hmm. But then there's this other political component that I think is important.
For politics.
Yes. Yeah. And it's also a moral component as well. And I'm sure we'll get into this discussion more in a bit. But since 9/11, it seems like commentators are quick to label acts of violence by people of darker skin or Muslims in particular as acts of terrorism. But when a white person commits a similar act, there's sort of conspicuous silence on whether or not that act is terrorism. It might be regarded as anomalous or just an act of murder.
Or, yeah, right, anomalous in terms of mental health and that sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
And so why is that political? So the imperative being that we need to be clear about what we mean by it because there are political ramifications.
Yes, but also I think at a deeper level, there's a sense in which it would be just to describe similar crimes consistently, regardless of who is perpetrating it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the definition, the description of terrorism and why it matters when it comes to the crime that occurred down in South Carolina last week when nine people were shot to death during a prayer meeting at an historically black church in Charleston. If you have a question or comment, what do you think the word terrorism and the definition of a terrorist should mean and whether or not it applies in this case? My guest is Jason Kiber. He is a visiting assistant professor of political science at Otterbein University. He has taught courses on terrorism at Ohio State University. What do we know about the history of how terrorism as a term has been used through time? It's a relatively modern notion.
It is. So with specific regards to sub-state actors, so when I use the term state, I mean like a country or a government. So with regard to sub-state actors, terrorism is a fairly modern phenomena. Scholars and historians would, I think, typically date it back to anarchist terrorism that started in the 19th century. And this is a time in which, on the continent of Europe in particular, many leaders and people associated with different monarchies feared for their lives because anarchist terrorism started to rack up a pretty big body count. But that type of terrorism was really focused. It was a limited form of terrorism that was focused on heads of state. And then over time, we see the targets of terrorism being broadened a bit to attack not only the heads of state, but those associated with them, and then broaden once more. And we see this in the modern form, the contemporary terrorism, to civilians, like the most innocent of innocent.
That's the specific act, but I have this feeling that ultimately it's still aimed at the state in so much as it's telling the state you can't protect the people, and it's going to the credibility of the state in a way.
Yeah, it does cut deeply at the credibility and perhaps the legitimacy of the state. I think it's helpful to think about terrorism as fundamentally an act of coercion. Right. So the people that are killed in an act of terrorism, from the terrorist perspective, their specific identities are kind of incidental. The act of terrorism is trying to send a message to a larger audience, and that is either the government or the population, broadly speaking. So to take the most obvious example, the attacks on September 11th, it's not as if al-Qaeda knew the identities of the people in the building, the Twin Towers. But the message was to the American government that al-Qaeda wants the American government to change policies. The message is to the American people that al-Qaeda wants them to stop supporting specific policies, et cetera. But different organizations, different ideologies that support terrorism are going to have slightly different agendas, and they're going to see different utility in using that type of violence against innocents.
So when you look at what Dylann Roof did down in Charleston last week, he told them why he was killing them. He had been with them for a while, so ostensibly he did know what their identities were, all
True.
Things being equal. At least he knew who the pastor was for sure,
yeah.
I would imagine. What does that all say to you? How does that come out in the wash for you?
Well, I mean, the way I look at this act of violence in terms of terrorism, and I do see it as an act of terrorism, I'm not sure why he picked that particular church, aside from the fact of its historical significance and its symbolic value. And individuals that choose terrorism to pursue their ends, they tend to be acutely aware of the symbolic value of their targets. So, again, back to September 11th, the most obvious example, the Twin Towers, the Pentagon. And here you have a historically black church with historical significance. As to why he lingered there with the congregants, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's particularly morbid. I'm not sure.
What's the difference in this case between a terrorist crime and a hate crime?
Well, different folks are going to give different answers to that depending on how they understand terrorism. Mm-hmm. More philosophical definitions of terrorism will likely just be comfortable with saying that hate crimes are themselves acts of terrorism. Sort of by definition, members of a certain community, a minority community, let's say, are targeted for the very reason that they're members of that minority community, and that act of violence is intended to send a broader signal to other people in that community to make them fearful, and ostensibly probably to make them change their behavior in some way. So under a more philosophical definition, a hate crime will always be an act of terrorism. Now, legally,
right.
things do matter. The terminology does matter. Under U.S. law, acts of terrorism will enact more strict penalties.
Even hate crimes?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure the very specific, mm-hmm. the specifics, but yes. And that's why, like the other day, the FBI director said that he doesn't see this as an act of terrorism, at least not yet. Mm-hmm. I guess the idea is that they're still investigating because he didn't see this political agenda. But if you read the manifesto,
he hadn't seen that yet.
Perhaps,
it was,
right.
It was immediately, we didn't know.
Right. But when the director's saying that, the director of the FBI, I mean, I think what he has in mind is that there are certain legal hoops that one would have to jump through to convict on a terrorism case versus another type of conviction, be it a hate crime or a murder. I'm not sure what those legal hoops are, but there are certain standards of evidence, et cetera, that matter.
Why do you think there is a debate or a conversation about this now?
Yeah, so I mean, this is where things get really interesting. When I first started reading about this, I assumed that the discussion was going to fall along like left-right political spectrum, that those on the left would say one thing and those on the right would say another. But it's actually much murkier than that. You have those on the right that are fine with calling it terrorism. There are different conspicuous absences of using that term in the media and maybe in conservative circles in particular. And that's an interesting question that we might want to delve into. Mm-hmm. But even on the left, we see different arguments. Some people say I noticed two different arguments in particular. One is that perhaps we shouldn't use the term, even if legally the crime fits an act of terrorism. But maybe politically we shouldn't use the term because describing Dylann Roof's violence as terrorism somehow elevates it. Somehow it's as if it would give credence to his sad, defunct ideology.
It's what he wants.
It's what he wants, precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. So in our discourse, we should just refer to him, if we refer to him at all, as just some pathetic criminal.
But he would not have the same sort of laws leveled against him.
Exactly. Though. Exactly.
Or punishments.
Right.
The greatest punishment then suggesting that the greater punishment could be don't give them the satisfaction of calling them a terrorist.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one can see the appeal of that argument. Mm-hmm. However, mm-hmm. We'll get into, I guess, some of this later. But one of the other arguments that I wanted to that I thought was interesting that I've seen kind of coming from the left in particular is that the word terrorism, because it's been so misused and just sloppily applied since September 11th, sort of bordering on meaningless nowadays.
Diluted.
It's diluted. So there's a sense in which some people just want to expunge the word altogether from the vocabulary. And then there's actually, I guess, one more critique of using the term in this case, and that is since September 11th, the term terrorism, the label, is inextricably bound up with this growth in U.S. military power and the militarization of U.S. policy.
The war against terror.
The war against terror in particular and the consequences of it. So in the aftermath of the Ferguson, Missouri riots and the militarization of the police bought some of that military surplus from the government, that was a product of the war on terror. This is a deeper critique. It's very interesting. So the idea would be, let's get rid of this sloppy term because it's already connected in a negative way to the growth of military power.
And the using the tools of that power against American civilians who are not terrorists.
Yes, at home. And then also using that military power in a sloppy manner mm-hmm. abroad, be it drone attacks, the war in Iraq in general. I mean, this would be the way the critique would run.
We're talking about the idea of terrorism, using it as a way to define someone like the man who killed 9 blacks at a historically black church in Charleston, South Carolina last week. If you have a question or comment, have thoughts, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about how we think about terrorism and who should be identified as a terrorist in the aftermath of the fatal shootings of 9 black people last week at a historic black church in Charleston, South Carolina. Still with us is political scientist and international relations specialist Jason Kiber. Joining us now by phone is the managing director of the Counterterrorism and Infrastructure Protection Division of the international security consulting firm TAL Global Corporation, Dr. Errol Suthers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You've written that any comprehensive definition should be based on three elements. What are those three elements, and how do they fit into this?
Well, the three elements that I described are really the essence of the activity being the use or threatened use of violence. The second element is the targets of that activity are civilians. And in this instance, local, state, federal law enforcement in the United States would qualify as civilians to differentiate civilians from military personnel.
Okay.
And the objective of the incident or the attack has to be political. And I might add that I'm also a professor. I teach abroad, particularly in Israel, and there have been debates about this for decades about whether or not we can define terrorism, and there's been no commonality here or abroad on how to define the term.
Why do you think that is? Why is it so hard?
Well, one of the things that's been particularly troubling years ago is that a number of nations, particularly Arab nations, were conveniently using the term as cover to suggest that some of their activities were being engaged in the furtherance of nationalism, of liberation and things like that. But they were, in fact, embracing these three elements, but then would say, well, this is an act of national revolution or something like that. And so because it's been used as cover, it's been really hard to nail down a definition that fits for everyone.
How do you think the shooter's own self-identification, how do you think that should figure into the equation?
I don't think it should figure into the equation. I think we should take each individual incident for what it is. I think we should look at these three elements and see whether or not they fit. You know, one of the challenges we have today is that anyone can go online and say, I belong to a group, I'm furthering the group. That, of course, is part of it. But I think independently, we have to look at the totality of the circumstances. I think in the most recent incident in South Carolina, it seems fairly clear to me and most of my colleagues. But I have challenges with individuals, particularly lately, that claim to be ISIS-inspired, if you will, mm-hmm. With regards to the legitimacy of what they're doing.
Well, all right. So what about that loner component? They have been influenced by groups and groups' writings on the internet or wherever, but they've acted independently. There's not a group with them.
Well, that could be true. It's not to say that if they're acting independently, that they're not, in fact, going to be defined as terrorists. I think one of the things that we do in the United States is we assume a loner is or is not automatically a terrorist. We also assume that because of the lethality of what they do, it's automatically a terrorist act. It need not involve an improvised explosive device. It need not involve a massive shooting. It depends on what they do, who's being targeted, and whether or not there's a political objective that we can clearly identify as being furthered by their action.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the definition of terrorism, the description of terrorism, the identification of it. My guests are, we just heard from Dr. Errol Suthers. He's the managing director of the Counterterrorism and Infrastructure Protection Division for the international security consulting firm TAL Global Corporation. Also with me in the studio, Jason Kiber. He's a visiting assistant professor of political science at Otterbein University. He's taught courses on terrorism at Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Carlos and Gehanna, you're on the air. Hi, Carlos.
Hello, how are you doing? I have a question that might involve guests. I see they make a definition between attacking civilians and attacking military members, but Hassan at Fort Hood killed 13 soldiers, and it was called workplace violence by the Obama administration. How is it killing 13 more people based on a jihad is not terrorism itself, and I'll take the answer off the phone.
All right, Carlos, thank you. Jason Kiber, can you talk about that?
Sure. The Fort Hood shooting that the caller referred to, I think using the criteria that Dr. Suthers mentioned and the criteria that I mentioned as well, which is very similar, the victims of that attack, they were innocent and they were non-combatants by virtue of the fact that they weren't in an active battlefield, right? They're at home at the military base. As to the categorization of the attack as workplace violence, that was something that the Department of Defense did. It is a suspect, but it was for, I'm not quite sure the purposes of the label. It's, first off, it's not as if President Obama labeled it as such. It was the Department of Defense, and there are implications for labeling an act as workplace violence versus an act of terrorism,
right,
in terms of the recognition of the deaths would.
All right. So what if it was some guy and he let's say a white guy in a predominantly African-American employed firm who's tired of, you know, has the same emotions as Dylann Roof. But, you know, it's a workplace violence thing, or is it terrorism?
Well, if this hypothetical individual, if he could not articulate any real political or ideological reasons,
okay,
if he just had a hatred for his coworkers, and maybe even if his hatred was based on the fact that his coworkers are black, if he couldn't really articulate a broader agenda, then it might not be considered an act of terrorism.
Errol Suthers, what about the Fort Hood incident?
Well, first, I agree with Mr. Kiber. I don't know why it was labeled workplace violence. My understanding is that that was a determination made by the Department of Defense attorneys in terms of prosecutorial procedure.
That's right.
I would say that based on what I know about Nadal Hassan historically, I would think that he certainly has checked off the three boxes to be labeled a terrorist incident. And when I lecture on that incident, I call it an act of terrorism.
Philip Bump in the Washington Post said that we shouldn't call Dylann Roof a terrorist, partly as a form of punishment. He wants to be a terrorist. Why give him the satisfaction, in other words? We talked about that a little earlier. Errol Suthers, what do you make of that?
Well, here's my challenge with that assertion. Then we need some consistency. Should we call the Sonayev brothers terrorists because they want to be called terrorists?
In the Boston Marathon.
Yes, in the Boston Marathon massacre, correct. So I would agree if there's a degree of consistency here. The problem is that there's not. We all too often label incidents terrorists based on ethnicity, nationality, race, or religion before we even get the facts. And in other cases, we're not that consistent. So if we could have a starting point nationally or internationally where we're going to call these people what they are, which is essentially murderers, I would have no problem with that. But there's an inconsistent labeling of terrorism based on some demographic or personal characteristics of the assailant before that's even known. And that's the troubling event.
I thought this was all sort of resolved in a way back many years ago when Timothy McVeigh was involved in the bombing of the Oklahoma Federal Office Building. What's the difference? There was a question at first whether he was even the perpetrator. He was let through because of he was, well, people have all kinds of notions about why. But what about that? Wasn't that a terrorist act? Errol Suthers?
Well, yes, it was a terrorist act, and there was some hand-wringing on that for a number of reasons. One, because he was a Caucasian male. Mm-hmm. He was a United States veteran. That was the real first incident we had in this country of domestic terrorism with someone who, unfortunately, I'll just say it, looked like us. So there was some consternation over that incident, and then finally we all agreed it was what it was. But it didn't come automatically. It wasn't as easily determined as we now look at it.
Connor Friedersdorf in The Atlantic this week said that when terrorism is invoked, many Americans have agreed to all sorts of limits on gifts to charities, ethnicity-based surveillance, and even the torture of people who might know about a future attack. And he went on to say that having plowed over so many civil rights or civil liberties in the pursuit of terrorism, the white majority is alarmed at the idea of the Homeland Security bureaucracy treating them as they've treated Muslim Americans.
Well, let me just say this. In today's New York Times, you're going to find out that since September 11th, nearly twice as many people have been killed by white supremacists, anti-government fanatics, and other non-Muslim extremists than by radical Muslims. So that's one of the things that we have to get over. And I would also add, in the interest of full disclosure, having been a former law enforcement officer and reaching the level of chief, in a recent poll and a survey that's coming out this week, they asked 382 police and sheriff's departments to rank the three biggest threats from violent extremism. 74% listed anti-government violence before they listed Al-Qaeda-inspired violence as their threat. And so we have to come to grips with the fact that we are now experiencing terrorism, if you will, by Americans in America that look like us.
Jason Kiber?
Yeah, just to piggyback on that briefly, I mean, what Dr. Suthers is pointing out really illustrates powerfully how out of step the contemporary discourse on terrorism is with the realities that America faces.
Why, Errol Suthers, why do we struggle with this? Why do we struggle with defining terrorism? Is it because we're grappling with the idea that does it all come down to race and ethnicity?
I think it comes down to a belief of two things. Number one, it was always, until recently, a faraway threat. We were protected by two large bodies of water called oceans, and we always felt like terrorism happens over there. We also have always believed that terrorism occurred by someone other than us, meaning other than Americans. And mm-hmm. So going back to your example of Timothy McVeigh, the challenge wasn't so much of what he did, but who did it. And so I think those are two realities that we have to come to grips with in the 21st century, that it happens over here, and we are capable of doing it.
Nick in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nick.
Hi. A pleasure to talk to you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a question about the four waves of terrorism model. Dr. Kiber started talking about the first wave of the anarchist model. I was wondering, I have a feeling Dr. Suthers is very familiar with it too, but I was wondering if there's some kind of institutionalization of that model that might be preventing people in the academy, like Dr. Kiber's peers, or even people in practical security initiatives, like in Dr. Suthers' field. Are you finding any kind of resistance to incorporating a new wave? Like the DHS report from, 6 years ago talked about the threat of right-wing extremism. I don't know if that's been embraced by the academy or by people in applied security fields.
Dr. Kiber?
Yeah. So what the caller's referring to is there's some scholarship that discusses what's called like four waves of terrorism. And these waves briefly are the anarchist wave that started in the 19th century, anti-colonial wave, followed by like a new leftist, like Marxist wave. And then the wave that we're apparently in today is this religious wave. This scholarship treats these waves as more or less coherent in their agendas. And they categorize them based on the fact that they have some sort of international presence. So this way of looking at terrorism kind of neglects, especially for the American experience, and neglects domestic terrorism. Hmm. So to the extent that international relations scholars think about terrorism, or national security scholars, I guess, more specifically look at terrorism, then I guess that wave of terrorism way of looking at it does it probably neglects a bit the domestic terrorism problem. In the DHS report that the caller refers to, I guess, was summarily ignored.
This is Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, this was shortly after the Obama administration first took office. Mm-hmm. And the report received a lot of pushback from conservatives because basically you had the Department of Homeland Security saying that, hey, the U.S. has a terrorism problem. And guess what? It also includes white supremacist, anti-government groups, hate groups as well. And, I mean, it turns out that that is the case.
Dr. Southers?
Yes. Just to add to Dr. Carver's comment, that 2009 report I'm extremely familiar with. I happened to be a presidential nominee when that report came out. And as he mentioned, that report was labeled right-wing extremism, which I think was an unfortunate error. It probably should have been a more holistic report on homegrown extremism. Hmm. And the troubling components were twofold. Number one, it talked about the right wing. And number two, it identified returning veterans as potential recruitees of these extremist organizations domestically. And so the report was withdrawn. And unfortunately, it wasn't there shortly thereafter. We had the shooting of two officers in Arkansas by sovereign citizens, a father and son team, who the father of one of those officers was the Chief Paul Dirt, who now has a 12-minute video on training people on sovereign citizens. And unfortunately believes that the information contained in that report that was withdrawn could have possibly saved his son's life had they been educated and more aware of a domestic threat called sovereign citizens.
Before I let you go, Errol Southers, could we talk about the ethical dilemma or the dilemma in general for journalists and how they approach this? They've, along with the others, have been reluctant to throw out the terrorist term. And NPR, for example, would say, well, it hasn't been officially declared. So since it is a legal term, we have to be careful about that.
I think that's a prudent way to proceed. And the only thing I would add in doing that is some consistency. I think if we're going to be reluctant to use this, the T word, mm-hmm. We should be reluctant when we have an individual who's the suspect with an Arabic or Muslim-sounding name. And I think that if we could have some consistency there, that would certainly be prudent, and I think it would be rational and logical.
Jason Kiber?
I agree with what Dr. Southers said. There's another angle on this that a lot of, like, the 24-hour cable networks, they're in the business of selling stories. Mm-hmm. A lot of their viewership is white. So, I don't imagine there's a lot of too much critical thinking on their part about how to be judicious in applying the term consistently, as we would hope they would. A lot of their coverage seems to try to sell the coverage itself to get viewership.
Bottom line is there may be ethical considerations, but there's no legal consideration. There's no law telling them what they can use and what they can't. Right. Yeah. Well, Errol Southers, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
It's Dr. Errol Southers. He's the managing director of the Counterterrorism and Infrastructure Protection Division for the international security consulting firm TAL Global Corporation. Coming up, we're going to hear from two leaders in the Muslim community here in Columbus about what their take is on this discussion. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thanks for joining us today. This is 89.7 NPR News. And in 20 minutes, join us for Wellness Wednesday and a conversation about young children and surgical anesthesia. A new study suggests that it could have an impact on the developing brain during unavoidable surgical procedures. Plus, the FDA bans trans fats. So what might that taste like? That and more on Wellness Wednesday. It's today from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Morning Edition on 89.7 connects Columbus to the world with in-depth coverage of important issues. NPR covers the globe.
These collapsed people are digging loved ones out of the rubble.
Central Ohio's largest radio news team covers your community.
To infect and kill cancer cells.
Essentially, we're trying to give cancer a cold sore, but the virus we're using...
Listen to The Difference, Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News. Global, local.
Well, Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the implications of the word terrorism in light of the shooting deaths of 9 people in the historic Black South Carolina church last week. Many Americans associate the idea of terrorism with something outside or from outside the country, especially with radical Islamists and their followers. We wanted to talk about the intersection of that association and the labeling of Dylann Roof, the South Carolina shooter, as a terrorist. Still with us is international relations and terrorism specialist Jason Kiber of Otterbein University, where he is a visiting assistant professor of political science. Jason, thanks again for joining us.
Yep.
And joining us now is Basil Mohammed Gohar. He's president of the board of directors of Masjid Omar, Columbus's oldest mosque. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
I should say welcome back.
Yes, thank you.
And Roman Iqbal, he's staff attorney for the Ohio chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Basil, what responses have you heard in regards to the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina?
Well, I wouldn't say that there's been a lot of discussion. It happened to coincide with a pretty busy time for us. It's the start of the month of Ramadan, and you know, that's been the focus here. And we try to not discuss politics during this time. We try to focus on our worship and so on and so forth. But for sure, this is something that affects us because, first of all, this is our homeland. This is our country. And it's a great tragedy. And, you know, we thankfully don't have to enter too deeply into the discourse because it's already happening. You see the headlines. Why is this not being labeled as terrorism? Why is this not happening? You know, this is a great tragedy. How is, you know, what's going on here? So we've been definitely paying attention and seeing what's going on, but I can't really speak to too much deep discourse about the matter aside from the tragedy and the loss of life.
And Roman, what about you?
You know, one of the discussions that we are listening from people and the Muslim community especially is that a lot of news organizations, including NPR, is not calling it terrorism, and that, you know, certainly the question is being raised and discussed within the Muslim community and, in fact, in the broader media as well, as to why is this not a terrorist act, considering, in fact, the other day I heard the FBI director said he was not sure if this was terrorism. And that certainly is something which is very puzzling, especially when this guy had a manifesto, Dylann. This guy, the site he chose was a symbolic site, and he had researched and he had gone to plantations and civil war sites, and he had done a lot of work. In fact, when he was doing the shootings, he left one of the people there. He didn't shoot them and told them that I'm leaving you so you can tell other people what I've done, which is just the very definition of terrorism, that I want you to go tell other people the terror I have created today with an intention so that that terror spreads within the community, the African-American community, that is. So for us, for the Muslim community, it certainly is very strange to hear this discussion where there is a reluctance to use the word terrorism.
Compared to, say, if it's Islamic-related or somebody from an Islam country.
Right, compared to if there was an act of terror. And we think Dylann is an act of terror. If an act of terror was committed by a person, a self-identified Muslim, there would be no debate, and it would be called a terrorism. And you know, like in the Boston bombing, the guy was a terrorist. I mean, you know, even though he was a self-identified Muslim, we don't have a problem with that. But what we want is for the standard to be applied equally.
So you agree, Basil Gohar, that he's a terrorist?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
It has sounded like the director of the FBI is reluctant because it has, in their minds, it's a legal procedure, it's a legal process, and it's a legal term. Does that matter?
Well, that always matters. Mm-hmm. If there is an additional element which has to be proven in a court of law, that would certainly be applicable in all cases. For anybody who you want to charge with terrorism, which does carry typically a longer sentence. But that is not a unique problem to Dylann. That would be a problem in all cases. And again, the discussion that we are having within the community is that if, you know, a person who self-identifies as a Muslim, who does an act of terror, if he's a terrorist, why is Dylan, who with all the evidence that we have seen certainly suggests that he wanted to create terror, why is he not called a terrorist?
What are the implications as far as the idea of a war on terrorism and what that means? Because I mentioned earlier in the program the assertion by Connor Friedensdorf in The Atlantic this week that one of the problems is that in the war against terrorism that's emerged primarily since 9/11, we've plowed over so many civil liberties in the pursuit of terrorism that the white majority is now alarmed that we'll the enemy could be us. And what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it's important to say the enemy is not those who do not wish to purvey terrorism. And that's exactly where we find ourselves, although I don't think everyone agrees with that. And that's they might be finding themselves in the same uncomfortable position that Muslims in America have found themselves for quite some time, Muslims in the world view, actually, even. So I think it's definitely uncomfortable, and we're sympathetic to that view. But we've had to come to terms with the fact that this is a problem that exists, and we have to deal with it within our community. And I think that it's, you know, perfectly reasonable that all communities look into their, you know, look within and see, do we have problems that need to be addressed, whether it's the, you know, the majority community here in the U.S., whether it's other minority communities or on the world scope. We all have different problems to deal with. This is just like that, basically.
Go ahead.
You know, I just wanted to address in a slightly related earlier point that Jason made, that some people are saying right now, let's not call him a terrorist because that would lionize him. That would sort of give him a larger than life
role. He self-identifies. He wants to be called
a
terrorist.
And then some are suggesting that let's not give him what he wants. Now, this is an argument, by the way, which has been made consistently by terrorism experts in fact, even by the Foreign Secretary for England, Jack Straw, a couple of years back, that let's not call these self-identified Muslims as terrorists because this is exactly what they want. These are people who are marginalized, and we should, instead of lionizing them and calling them terrorists, we should call them the fools they are. And that has been rejected. No media organization has accepted that. And in fact, and I'm sure Jason can comment on that, terrorism experts have consistently said that Muslims, self-identified Muslims who are committing these acts, you know, to call them terrorists is basically giving them what they want. But
it gives them a certain amount of creed.
Creed.
Yeah.
And what they are common criminals, and that's what we should call them. But certainly if you look in the media and in the larger discourse in the country, that is something which is being ignored.
Yeah. All right. So, Jason Kiber, what's the argument? What's been the argument against doing that?
Well, in academic circles, we simply use the word terrorism or the concept terrorism to study empirically a specific type of violence, right? And we, as social scientists, we want to know, why does this violence happen? Under what conditions does this violence happen? And again, it's a particular type of violence, right? It's violence against innocence for this promotion of some larger political or ideological purpose. So social scientists use it for this purpose, right? Definitions, concepts are defined for very specific reasons, right? So the government and the government will define terrorism for legal and policy purposes. Scholars will define it for other purposes. So I think there's a difference here. The media discourse in here, I think this really touches on what Roman is saying. We could sort of expunge that word or use it more carefully. That's consistent with still allowing the term to be used in academic circles for like empirical work.
In legal circles.
In legal circles to try crimes with harsher penalties, et cetera. It's hard for, I think, somebody that's thinking about this for the first time to wrap their minds around that, how we could use the term in one mm-hmm. discourse, the media discourse, or rather not use it, or ideally use it more consistently, but still have it a part of the fabric of the legal discourse, a fabric of scholastic discourse, et cetera.
But we still obviously dither over it so much more when a majority white American is the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I first heard about the Oklahoma City bombing and when people first started talking about it, there was this really broad assumption, even back then, you know, pre-9/11, that it was from someone from the outside attacking Americans, and not an American attacking an American. And when you both joined us in this last segment, I said, I bet you've been wanting to have this conversation for a long time. And sadly, it's because of a horrible tragedy. What do you say to people out there about why this matters?
Well, you know why? To go back to my earlier point on why it matters is that when, you know, the terrorism experts have been saying for a while now that to call these people, you know, when self-identified Muslims are committing these acts, to call them acts of terror, to call them terrorists, is to make them larger-than-life figures. Mm-hmm. And this argument has not been accepted in the larger discourse in the media and within the political community in America. Now what this does now is that when we have the Dylan case, this horrific shooting, I think the discussion now is being made that maybe we should not give him a platform by calling him a terrorist. And our hope is that why this is important is that the same standard can also be applied when a self-identified Muslim also commits an act of terror.
That'll be the test, won't
it? That would be the test. And the other point I want to also make, which is very important, is that, you know, there was a police research forum survey of and there's an article in New York Times of the majority of law enforcement agencies in America considered threats from sovereign citizens, right-wing militias, to be a bigger terrorist threat. In fact, there is some research that since 9/11, the fatalities have been 500% more from militias and sovereign citizens than from self-identified Muslims. And that is something certainly we want the community to know and people to know.
We still have time for a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do you think that moment, if it ever comes, when the media and the authorities stop short of assuming and immediately identifying as a terrorist somebody from an Islamist or right-wing, or I mean an Islamist extremist group or another religious group, when they stop short and pull back like they have with the Dylan Roof case, that'll be a sign that things have changed?
Well, I think that we're struggling here in the U.S. with a lot of prejudice generally. I mean, you know, what we've seen in what's happened in Ferguson and in other parts of the country with the racial profiling and you know, police brutality and violence against, you know, ethnic minorities and in particular African-Americans, it's really that is part of the bigger problem, which is that we are more comfortable to apply labels to people based on whether it's physical attributes or differences of what they look like. When you know, for lack of a better term, the other, someone who's different from us. I think that's the greater problem. It takes form and shape in these cases, whether it's terrorism, whether it's, assumption of, you know, criminal behavior or criminal intent based on appearance, and so on and so forth. This is the case. And what frustrates us, I guess, more and more as Roman already has pointed out, is it's factually disproportionately applied against Muslims in America that, you'll find frequently quoted that, I'm not saying all Muslims are terrorists, but we know all terrorists are Muslims. That's a very common quote, and it's factually wrong to a very strong degree. We just don't know how to, how do we have an intelligent discourse when that's the assumption that someone brings up and that's what they carry with them.
Mahadi, you're on the air. We're just about out of time. I wanted to get you on, though. Welcome. Mahadi?
Hello.
Hi. We're just about out of time. I wanted to get you on. Welcome.
Okay. I just want to say that I agree with my two Muslim brothers that what Mr. Roof did is a terrorism, and it's not only terrorism. It's the essence of terrorism. Secondly, we're not only called the Islamic terrorists, this one, Muslims do this, but we call them other good names like Islamist, jihadi. And these are honorable names in our religion. And we don't want someone to call them Islamists, because if they are Islamists, then what are first of us?
Oh, okay. All right. And the same we think with jihadists. Agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what President Obama said earlier when we had discussion in March, is that when you start using these terms, you are giving these people what they want. And that is something we want to avoid.
That broad brush stroke. Right. Well, I want to thank you, Roman Iqbal, for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Roman Iqbal, he's staff attorney for the Ohio chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And also Basil Mohammed Gohar, thanks to you as well.
You're welcome. Thank you, then.
Basil Mohammed Gohar, he is president of the board of directors for the Masjid Omar Mosque. And Jason Kiber, thanks for joining us this hour.
Happy to be here.
Jason Kiber, visiting assistant professor of political science at Adarbein University. He has lectured on and taught courses on terrorism at Ohio State University as well. And thanks to you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.